Feminist Money, the money podcast for feminists who want change. Welcome to Feminist Money. We'll be covering four stories on the podcast, including most feminist city in the world. Is the Swedish city of Umeå a feminist utopia? We won't go back Women's March. Why are women rallying for feminist causes before the US election? Antigua and Barbuda colonial laws challenged. Why are colonial laws still governing abortion access?
And finally, here's a feminist you should know.
This week, it's Merle Thornton of the Pub Protest. And on that note, onward with the podcast. In our first story, is the Swedish city of Umeå a feminist utopia? Now, I don't know about you, but it doesn't actually feel easy to be a woman right now. We tend to see things getting easier for different groups of women and we assume the work's done, or we see equality as this cake and we assume that women have had their share of equality cake for the day. Well, equality rights aren't cake, and if they were, to quote Lindsay Lohan in Mean Girls, the limit doesn't exist. I love cake. And it does feel tough when I don't have cake available and I find myself seeking a society where those decisions about how I might choose to use my life or my body, those decisions aren't put to a committee. And that's what I'm really craving right now, honestly. And a trip to Sweden might just fit the bill. No, not IKEA, actual Sweden, and specifically the city of Umeå. Now, where is it? It's a 7-hour train ride directly upwards from Stockholm on the East Coast. But what sets it apart is how the city has made a concerted effort to ensure that given cities are so often founded by men and made in their image, in their city, in the design of their city, they also started to shape it around women. You see that immediately in the art in the city centre. Most cities have a statue of typically their male founders and occasionally a politician or two. But in this city, they have a world first. A public statue dedicated to the hashtag MeToo movement. It's a glorious red cougar that locals affectionately call Pullman or the Puma. It stands at 4.3 meters high, towering above you in the town hall square with powerful muscles roaring and the title, Listen. It's there for a reason. It states the city's position on sexual harassment and it's intended to ensure that people do what the statue asks them to do, to listen to the roar of women when they do speak on issues like that. So after you've admired a red cougar statue, why not then visit the Women's History Museum? It opened 10 years ago to represent the challenges taken over time to see the needs of women recognised. When the head of the city's building committee was interviewed a year ago, they really highlighted the visibility of women in naming schools and roads after women who were really important to the city to increase their visibility in public life. But they also showed how even decisions at a minutiae level are made with women in mind, such as prioritizing clearing bicycle paths when it snows, because in the city, women ride bicycles more than men. You also see that in how they've designed the station, with a new tunnel established 12 years ago, which means women aren't needing to walk home in the dark. And you've got wider sidewalks, which means if you're raising children in a stroller or if you need to use a wheelchair, you can access those public spaces much more comfortably and confidently. These are moves to showcase women, to take up space, and to also prioritize their safety when they're using those spaces. There's another move that if you love sports or if you've got children that love sports, you'll love this. The soccer stadium or football stadium, depending on where you live, was once really the vestige of men, where once it was the men's team that had their pick at the training slots and the women just made do. But it was a decision made in the 1990s that it was the team who produced the best results that was going to get to pick the best time to train, regardless of their gender. What really helps the city's decision makers is the statistics that exist around gender, so they can identify where gaps are in gender access and how different genders use public spaces, and then design initiatives to help close those gaps. The financial aspect of this is highlighted by the fact that these are public funds. This is government money, and it is used to prioritize the needs of women. It's going to be used anyway. So why not prioritize women? To look at data and ask questions around who uses spaces and who doesn't, how they use them, and how the city can design better things to ensure gender equality exists in public space. When we think of nations like Sweden, I think we can often typically put them in the progressive category. We assume that when we talk about a city being more feminist, everyone in that city and in the wider country would be supportive of feminism. Unfortunately, though, even in utopia, it doesn't mean that someone isn't hammering on the door and people aren't champing at the bit to reverse feminist progress. For example, candidates as recently as the 2022 election were threatening to remove that Listen statue from the city centre. And you see it nationally too. While the Swedish national government moved away from feminism, including scrapping its feminist foreign policy, the city itself, in its municipal election at the time, voted to stick with the feminist focus. Even within the city, though, there is protest, such as when the city's soccer stadium prioritised the best performing team, that move in the 1990s, there were protests. And there were protests against the fact that it could disadvantage men in prioritising women. But what sets this city apart is when the decision makers have these protests, they see them, but they don't allow it to outbalance the evidence they have. They don't allow it to water down the initiatives beyond the point of why they exist, to support gender equality. And that's a lesson we can all take from this story to our own cities. Government officials want to be re-elected, and it's important that you, as an individual, as a citizen, start to notice where women do go, where they don't go, and start by asking why. For our second story, why are women rallying for feminist causes before the US election? Women across the country took to the streets to rally this weekend in Washington, D.C. and in other cities. They rallied in support of causes that gave the women the right to choose, including abortion rights. And I took heart from the fact that it wasn't women alone, it was the men standing alongside them that were arguing for these rights. And it did feel very reminiscent of 2016. Groups found their original pink hats and got creative in their rally signs. You'll love a few of the signs that came up. Row, row, row your vote, referencing Roe versus Wade. Grab him by the ballot, referencing when one of the presidential candidates said that he could just grab women by their private parts because he was well known. Uncle Sam, stay out of my clam, referencing the want of women for governments to stop trying to control their bodies. And sometimes you just gotta flush twice, referencing the fact that we've already experienced a Trump presidency before, and spoiler, it wasn't good. And the final sign, which I think summarizes everything, we won't go back. And that is why women are rallying. Because in 2016, many assumed that either America would get its first female president, or they gave Trump the benefit of the doubt. They got behind him as the president because he might not be that bad. Well, unfortunately, we experienced Trump in power, and it was that bad. It has made things worse for many American women, including on the issue of fertility and when we decide to get pregnant. That right has been continually under attack since Trump-era appointees to the US Supreme Court reversed a national ruling, Roe v. Wade, which helped establish choice and access as guiding principles of healthcare. And since then, in many states and cities, women have been struggling to access the healthcare they need. And Trump is held to a different standard when he talks, for example, describing himself as the father of fertilization, with no evidence for that claim. He hasn't made fertility treatments easier to get. In episode 2 of this podcast, we discussed how IVF treatments have been paused in Alabama, for example, where family planning was completely put on hold, and it factually limited the access of women to have a family. So Trump hasn't helped fertility, he's removed the choice we had. I think that removal of choice is also best summarized by a more recent quote that Trump will protect you whether you like it or not. This is a key feminist vote around a woman's right to choose and to have agency in her life. But it's also a key financial decision. The person who gains power in the US election will have 4 years of public funds to help shape the country and through its foreign office and influence to help shape the US contribution to the world. Because parties with values alignment in different countries, both in the more progressive and more conservative camps, talk to each other, that this US election result will influence policy development and how politicians talk about issues in countries far beyond the US borders. This is why we should all care what happens to different countries. And it's also why on this podcast, we take this intersectional approach of thinking beyond our own borders, because in this era, the borders are much less relevant to the issue of feminism and the policies that drive it forward. And thankfully, in the US, many women are seeing it. Surveys suggest a gender split in how people are voting, with women far more likely to be voting for Harris over Trump. And that means if women show up and vote, given our size of population, if we rally, as the women did this weekend, we can avoid going back. I love the rally this weekend, and I want to give the final word to one of the grandmothers marching, who marched with one of my favorite signs, "Even wine can't fix this," as she marched, in her words, "for all women everywhere." For our campaign story this week, why are colonial laws still governing abortion access? That's the challenge activists are pursuing in Antigua and Barbuda as they work alongside doctors and nurses towards change. Currently, abortion is only accessible in the country if a woman's life is in danger, and under these rules, women face 10 years in prison and those who help them face 2. The problem is the laws stem from when the country was under colonial rule, and they simply don't reflect healthcare requirements of women today, which is why it was a doctor and a not-for-profit organization that has challenged the existing law in court. A doctor brought the case because it's about access to healthcare. There are similar laws in countries in the region, such as Jamaica, where you could face life imprisonment for getting an abortion, and those assisting you could face 3 years in prison. While it's rarely enforced as a law, the occasional arrest of doctors performing the procedure does limit access through fear. And that's where it becomes a financial issue, because in Jamaica, in Antigua and Barbuda, and indeed in the US, if you have the money to travel to access an abortion out of the country, you can. You will have access to healthcare options. The reason we have these discussions is for the women who don't. They are reliant on whatever option they can legally access in the country, including not having the option and being reliant on the courage of your doctor to risk prison time to give you the healthcare you require. Back to Antigua and Barbuda, when I say the doctor and activists had launched a challenge to colonial law, I really did mean the word challenge. The High Court allowed the case to proceed despite the government moving to block it. Religious leaders have huge influence, and they are now also trying to get added to the lawsuit as an interested party. The case is scheduled for a hearing in Antigua's High Court, and attorney Sherry Ann Bradshaw, who filed the challenge, is hopeful that if they win, they could make this landmark decision that ripples and helps other jurisdictions to move towards healthcare reform.
And finally, here's a feminist you should know. This week, it's Mel Thornton at the pub protest.
So who was Mel Thornton? Mel was described by the previous Queensland Minister for Women, Shannon Fentiman, as leaving behind a legacy that will forever inspire generations of women and girls to continue to fight for equality. Her defiance on gender inequality became a symbol of resistance. Mel's story comes to us from the east coast of Australia, where in 1965, Merle and another feminist activist, Rosalie Bogner, made history when, after the bartender refused to serve them. In response, both women chained themselves by their ankles to the bar at the Regatta Hotel in sunny Brisbane. It reminds me of Girl Guides and Scouts, as they took the motto "Be prepared" to heart, and they even brought the chain and padlocks with them, just in case the bartender didn't play ball. At the time, women were banned from drinking in pubs and public spaces in Queensland, and so by chaining themselves to the bar, Merle and Rosalie sent a very clear message. We're not going anywhere. It wasn't just about being able to enjoy a drink. At the time, Merle Thornton said, "It's not just that we think this is the most important issue of discrimination against women. There are many more important issues like the equal pay issue, but it's something we thought we could make a quick impact on." Speaking of the pay issue, this was something Merle herself had been impacted by, because laws at the time included the marriage bar, which meant women had to resign from the Australian Public Service when they married. Merle herself had to resign from the ABC due to this law, because after keeping her marriage secret from her employer, her pregnancy meant that she, and I quote, was deemed to have resigned. It essentially judged women as past their sell-by date as individual employees in the Federal Public Service in Australia if they deigned to follow the societal expectation at the time, which most did, of getting married. So what happened after the pub protest of 1965? Well, the law that Mel Thornton was fighting against was removed 5 years after that protest. And it became a visual movement of change for women by drawing eyeballs to a relatable space, the neighborhood pub, and the ridiculousness of a law that had outgrown its relevance. A cold brew is practically a pastime in Australia, but in 1965, it is one that women simply could not enjoy. Mel also started the Equal Opportunities for Women Association, which she led in women's rights campaigns to ensure that women could more fully participate in society. That included a campaign around the removal of that marriage bar law, the same law that had impacted her a few years earlier, which meant that women no longer had to leave their jobs after getting married. Her work at the University of Queensland led to her founding the Women's Studies course, which was a joint first move with another university in Australia, which established gender studies as a recognised course of study and research in the country. And then, 55 years after Merle first chained herself to that bar as a visual protest, she returned to the university in 2020 to receive her honorary doctorate. Merle left a legacy as a feminist activist who helped ensure that women could keep their jobs, fully participate in the workforce, and of course, then attend the after-work drinks at the pub to network if they chose to do so. She passed away in August, and the tributes to her show the mark she left in helping shape the feminist movement in Australia.
So thank you to Merle Thornton at the pub protest, A Feminist You Should Know.
And that's the episode for this week of Feminist Money. You can find any of the stories that we cover today in our episode description if you want to learn more about them. And if you enjoyed the episode, please just tap that rating bar and give us a quick rating or review because it really helps other people find us. And that reach means we can continue and expand. So a big thank you if you've got the time to do so. I've been Kate. This has been Feminist Money. And onwards, my gorgeous feminist friends.